Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Vanity Fair.
Oh, shit, it's so cold. I'd murder my family for a scarf. One scarf and slit their throats.
Hello, and welcome to Still Watching, a weekly television podcast from Vanity Fair. I'm Chris Murphy.
I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Hilary Busis. We are here to discuss episode 4 of HBO's The Regime, and the episode is called Midnight Feast.
What is this? Well, it gets a bit pokey in my cell, so Tom and Vin like to bring me here in the tunnels for the odd midnight feast.
And later, we've got a big league. Hugh Grant is stopping by to talk about his time as the former chancellor of our fair Genovia.
But first, let's do a quick recap. Zubak is in prison and is tormented by the chancellor's daily radio addresses. But he makes a new friend, drumroll please, former chancellor Ed Keplinger.
You are in the countryside.
Am I? Gosh, well, I hardly seem to be.
Elena's new pro-China stance isn't going well. A pregnant protester is killed by a horse and becomes the catalyst for unrest.
That's all this is about. A horse. It's absurd. Horses spook. That's just what they do. Oh, no. Maybe it was me who told Horsey to kick that woman. Clip-clop, clip-clop, kick.
Yeah. Elena ventures out of the palace for the first time in a long time to meet with the Westgate Sugar Beet Union. Meanwhile, Keplinger tries to bring Zubak to his side.
I think it's over. I think she's finished. Now, we're still captives to her whims. We may die with her regime. But if we do survive, we need a plan.
We?
Oui. Oh, yes.
Keplinger's plan backfires and Zubak kills him. And while there is talk of civil war, Elena sends for Zubak to return to the palace.
I want to fuck you.
Chris, I think that you and I deserve some kind of prize for being right.
Are we going to get a one-way trip to Turkmenistan?
Maybe a different former Soviet bloc country.
Yeah, okay, that. But we were completely right.
We were right. Here's Hugh Grant. Here he is. Yeah. Former chancellor.
You were briefly right because
Ed. Well, and then there he went.
Yeah, which I was so disappointed by because this was the episode where I was like, oh, like genuine political intrigue, like, you know, another player enters the game. And it's this great actor who everyone loves. And then it was just like, oh, and then he's gone.
It felt a little bit like, I don't know how you guys feel about The Last of Us more broadly, but it felt a little video gamey like that show did where it's like, we're going to introduce these new characters. We're on a new level. Mm-hmm. Like, they're going to have something interesting to do, and then at the end of it, they're going to be dead, and we're just going to move on to the next thing. I was disappointed by that, too. I feel like you have the potential there for something richer and, like, more propulsive and, you know, to go in more surprising directions. I mean, I guess, you know, it's sort of interesting that Elena put him in jail specifically to kill Keplinger, but I don't know why she wouldn't have just done that. Like, why did she need him to?
She could have herself. Yeah, I don't know what we were supposed to sort of gather about either Zubak or, like, the Elena-Zubak dynamic that was served by killing off Ed so quickly. And I will say, not to, again, circle back to the last episode where I was like, I think we might not see Zubak again. That's sort of exactly what happened to Ed. And it's more of a pas de deux between Zubak and Elena than I thought. Like, mm-hmm. obviously, it's a character study of Elena and, like, why she is the way that she is. But Zubak really is coming to the fore in a way that we're sacrificing other characters, Ed, who we hardly knew ye, for what? Like, I was like, okay, he's a violent guy. He's still in love with Elena. We sort of get all of this stuff. He didn't read the book. I just don't know what, storytelling-wise, we were really supposed to grasp from killing Ed.
That he's really devoted to her, that that love conquers all.
You have to have a dream. You got to have something to believe in. It's not just enough of a political, you know, a political ideology is not enough to, you know, galvanize the masses. And I do think it was interesting, at the end of the episode, you know, we're sort of supposed to believe that Ed is this, like, leftist, you know, Marxist, like, man of the people. And then he turns out to be, you know, as patronizing and as rude to poor people, you know, Rhea Zubak as Elena. You know, you people, you don't read, you don't have your best interest at heart, you don't listen to
He called him a deplorable.
He called him a deplorable. He did,
okay,
basically.
But here's the problem with the messaging there. It's that he's right. Like, he is correct to say that.
That felt like the show speaking most directly to camera, you know, about, like, people who vote for Trump and people, you know, not all people who vote for Trump, but, like, the people who are, like, MAGA, you know, whatever. Like I just felt like that was Will Tracy, or I mean, he was not the credited writer on the show, but that was the show sort of making an editorial statement to us in a way that I don't think it has before.
Yeah.
And I didn't mind it, but— You're right, Chris, that it did. I think it was both supposed to be, we're supposed to agree with it, but it's also was supposed to reveal something bad about Ed in a way.
But we still didn't know him well enough to really...
Exactly. Yeah, and I think that we were served this one fascinating conversation between Elena and Ed.
But you do have a wonderful way with half-wits. They just eat you up.
And they spit you out.
The butchers. Well, they really devour your bullshit.
You effete old peacock with your gay book to lapsang. Babbling your left-wing dissertations.
No, I suppose I should have been fucked in the head like you. Broken people really love broken people, don't they?
I can't help it that I'm interesting and you're not.
I want to know so much more about why she kept him there. I mean, he's basically in a prison that's connected to the palace because she doesn't really ever want to leave. Mm-hmm. And like, and there's clearly an intimation of maybe a past dalliance between the two of them. Mm-hmm. And to kind of introduce that and then just sort of brush it away, that was disappointing. Because I think if we were going to have this character be the mouthpiece for the idea about, like, why do people support people like you, you know, these mm-hmm. dictators, whatever, it's not quite enough to say it once. Mm-hmm. You know, like I kind of wanted more of that ideology to kind of guide the show to the end. But.
Yeah, and I think I was complaining about this last week, or we sort of talked about this last week, for a show that sort of feels nowhere really and is amorphous and is not super sharp and is not really making not an incisive critique, but like could be more based in our actual reality. This was one moment where I was like, oh, we're really making a really strong statement. Yeah. It's a really sharp political critique, and it would be interesting to tease that out as to how are we supposed to feel about Ed after he, you know, says this to Zubak and after he is pretty terrible and yet speaking truth to Zubak about his blind allegiance to Elena, but we'll never get that because now he's dead.
Yeah, that and, you know, it's world building. It's giving a sense of the past. It's giving us a new character. It's giving us some new settings. And then it just sort of seems like all of that is erased by the end of the episode and we're back to where we began.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right. That's the right term is the world building. And, you know, I kind of started rolling my eyes at that term, you know, over the years with, like, Marvel and Game of Thrones and all that. But, like, I also have come to depend on it in a way from certain
kinds of... It's necessary when you're starting from scratch like this.
Because, like, everyone is so... like, everyone else on the show who isn't Nikki or Elena or Zubak or, to some extent, Agnes is, like, a kind of, like, nameless functionary. You know, they've mentioned their names out loud, but we don't really know who they are. And here entered Ed with a character we already sort of knew something about before he even, you know, was physically present on the show, played by this great actor. And I was like, okay, and the show suddenly started to feel fuller. Mm-hmm. And I appreciated that. I guess we also do have, like, the development of Agnes's. We had talked last week about, like, she's probably our sympathetic character to follow, but what's her end game going to be? And now I think, have started to see the start of that. So that made me feel at least somewhat better about Hugh Grant only being on the show for an episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we gave her a little bit more to do, but even in the way that we gave her more of a arc and Now we're like, okay, she's got to escape the palace. She's got to get out of this palace that's getting locked down with her son in tow. For it to happen, you know, cryptically over text, again, I'm like trying to get some momentum, trying to get really excited and really invested, and it's hard when it, you know, I'm just watching words sort of go on a screen and not like there's no, you know, person. I mean, the phone call was interesting, you know, who is she talking to on the phone? Who are these Americans that say that they can save her?
Well, but, they have a Delaware area code, which I thought was very interesting.
Yeah.
It's Hunter Biden.
Yeah. I mean,
Hunter Biden doing a rescue mission in Genovia.
Wow. Wow. The right's going to have a field day with this one. Yeah.
Maybe it's me. Maybe it's how I'm watching it or when I'm watching it, but I'm that sort of forward momentum and finding that person who I'm supposed to be on this journey with. Agnes emerged, but even so, I am a little, I don't want to say apathetic, but not as, I think, engaged as I could be.
Mm-hmm.
You guys mentioned something. Did I miss that it was confirmed that she had put him in prison to murder Ed?
Well, I mean, when she lets him out at the end, that is sort of that was how I took it. Like, I took it that she imprisoned him like for this reason, and maybe that's just me like making a like jumping to a conclusion that the show didn't intend, and that like his reward is then being released.
I thought she was just keeping him close, like she was keeping Ed close. But I don't know. Maybe I might have missed it.
They're both possible. Yeah. I mean, maybe she didn't intend that he would kill him,
but doesn't mind that it happened.
Yeah.
No. Well, we get that sort of shot of her like waking up after he's dead, sort of after a dream, sort of like smiling to herself. And I was like, oh, are we playing again on that sort of like their psychic bond, that sort of that dream connection that they have? But I also thought that it went her way, but it wasn't necessarily like her exact plan. Like, in 4 months, Zubak will murder Ed, and that's what I want. Because again, couldn't she have just done that herself?
Yeah, so it's probably, so then I think, yeah, maybe my initial assessment then is off in that it wasn't this like grandmaster plan. Maybe she just doesn't have grandmaster plans.
She has a private prison where she keeps handsome men who have betrayed her or whom she has betrayed.
And gives one of them a very like handsomely appointed cell with leather-bound books.
Yeah.
And
which is why I wanted to know more about their past relationship. Like, did they once respect each other? You know, like, I mean, we were reminded again in this episode in a semi-poignant way that Elena was a doctor in a former life and, like, you know, all this stuff. So maybe she and Ed were just among their Genovia's elite and were kind of socially friendly, and then the political ambition kicked in or something.
Yeah, and we get a little sense of his history, too, when he kind of drops his mask and is like, where is my family?
Yeah.
And she's like, oh, maybe in Lisbon, I don't know.
Perhaps.
Right.
So, yeah, there's clearly, you know, it's not, there's more to this relationship and there's more to whatever, like, twisted, not connection, but whatever, you know, she is using Ed for, and like, you know, that he will participate in the propaganda videos, I guess, because she's also blackmailing him. I don't know. That's interesting.
Yeah. Like, yeah. I also liked that we in the audience at least fell victim to one piece of propaganda in that, you know, that Ed was actually not in the mansion. Because that's, I think that's what I was, if when he showed up, that's what I was expecting to see.
Yeah.
And that actually, nope, it's all been a lie is interesting. And it makes me question a little bit, like, what else about this sort of facade of the show or the story is not what it seems. Maybe that was their big reveal and now it's done, but I don't know. But I don't know. I liked the add of intrigue in this episode. I think that was maybe had been missing a little bit in the first three.
Yeah. What did you think of Elena's breakdown at the children's press conference?
I thought it was well acted. Yeah. I think that you know, any kind of unexpected nosebleed at an awkward time is always going to make me, like, I have to, like, kind of look away from the screen. Not because of the blood. It's just like, oh, God, that's, like, just such an interesting manifestation always of, like, discomfort.
But it's also like you cough into a handkerchief and then you look and, like, realize that there's blood and it turns out that you're going to be dead in the next, like, hour maybe.
Yeah, exactly.
But this one had an explanation just because it's so goddamn cold in that castle.
I didn't believe that a kid wouldn't have complained loudly about the cold.
Knowing what I know about children. I mean, I also... A comic license, fine, but, like, does perimenopause make you that hot that you're in a bathtub filled with ice?
I didn't want to say that it may have jumped the shark a little bit this episode, but it was a little bit like, okay, like...
But then don't you sort of, I mean, now I'm contradicting myself. Don't you want it to either be, like, more real or more absurd? Because that's, like, when she's in the bathtub and she's saying, like... Like, you are very stupid, and I, like, want you not to be, or something. Like, those are, like, kind of...
And it makes me want to kill you.
Yes, exactly.
I was laughing. I was like, oh.
I laughed.
I was like, oh, It's
putting too fine a point on it, but I don't know. The bluntness was funny to me.
Yeah.
In a way that I don't know if this is really like a funny ha-ha show otherwise.
It's clever, but yeah, I know what you mean, Hillary, about wanting it to go one way or the other.
It makes me distrust all of you, and it makes me want you to be dead.
That made me laugh out loud. Yeah.
I also like the image of her lowering down above the conference table. I think that my question about where I wanted the show to go, if I wanted it to be really, really high satire, or if I wanted it to be more of a political, not thriller exactly, but something approaching that, was kind of confirmed when I sort of sat forward, closer to the screen when this kind of political intrigue stuff happened. I guess that's what I've been craving.
Got it.
Yeah.
Less than the comedy, but those moments are you're like, okay, there is humor here, but maybe they should tease it out, if they're going to do it.
Well, yeah, and then I guess that brings us a little bit to the very end with, Elena and Subak sort of confirming their love, consummating their love. Mm-hmm.
As she, does the Reichstag fire.
Yeah.
Yeah, right, exactly. I mean, yeah, in front of Nikki.
And in front of Nikki, in front of everybody, in front of the whole cabinet, who are just going to let her do whatever she wants to do. And it's like, okay, what do we make of that? The yo-yoing of Subak from up, down, up, down, up, down is compelling and I feel, a journey that people go through in administrations to some degree. But again, I'm a little bit like, okay, is this all we're watching? She loves him, she hates him. She loves him, she hates him. Again, when we had the political intrigue, the political prisoners, the Marxists, the leftism, that also caused me to lean in and be like, oh, okay, what's the bigger picture here? But it seems to be boiling down to Zubek and Elena. Yeah.
I feel like each episode, and maybe, kind of like talking about the video game aspect of it. Like each episode has felt different tonally in a way that I am a little bit caught off guard. And this one I think was in some ways the most enjoyable for me. But I also may be wary/curious about what's going to be next because months are passing in between episodes. And, I guess my understanding of the show now is that it's just about collapse. It's about the very tail end of this regime. And the reason they have to skip time and the mood or the tone changes is because this person at the center is losing her grip on everything. And that would be beyond belief if it happened over the space of a fake month or whatever. Yeah. It needs to be more like a year plus.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. The limited aspect of it. It's even for a limited series, it's kind of short.
Yeah. Six episodes. It's flying by. And I guess, to be fair, there is still political intrigue with Elena planting all those guns and money in the sugar beet union. That was interesting to me too. Her, busting up this union, pretending to be like, oh, we're going to give you reforms. We're going to keep China out and we're going to, bring back the sugar beet farms, which were two episodes ago, the whole reason for the season. And now we're getting, shutting down one by one. But for her to continuously be so corrupt and for her to get her little henchmen to plant these guns and this money, I was like, oh, okay. That also made my ears perk up and be like, oh, okay, I think she's bad, but she gets worse and worse and worse and worse and to a sort of an unbelievable degree, but in a way that, Kate Winslet is so great and such a fantastic actor that I am along for the ride with her. But I guess when we zoom out into the show as a whole, that's where I lose my footing, I would say.
Yeah. I did think it was interesting because I hadn't realized it, that this is the first time we've seen Elena leave the palace, right? I guess we saw her leave to go to the underground prison or whatever, but she hasn't left the grounds, and then she gets in the car and she's got all her stuff. And
her oxygen mask.
Yeah.
Her lorazepam.
And the reason for this trip is really grim. I mean, this story about this pregnant woman who was kicked by a horse that was what startled by the police or military people
during
or something
during protests.
Yeah. And so she's become this emblem. That's another way where I'm like, and she does cop to it in this episode. She's like, I'm losing them. I've lost them or whatever. But does Elena, what does she think that all these people rioting and protesting on the outside in the outside world are going to do to her? I don't know. It just her optimism or her belief that she can still somehow turn things around seems sort of silly at this point because things have gotten to the point of no return, I think.
Yeah, and obviously we have her on the propaganda machine just saying this doesn't exist, this isn't happening, it's all America's fault and whatnot. And I think Kate Winslet is, you know, such a good actress that we're seeing that, you know, she doesn't believe all the things that she's saying. But to what degree does she believe that she's really in danger? That is unclear, except for the fact that she's taken out enemies left and right. The Sugar Beet Union, boom. Mm-hmm. She's taking names. But I am, I'm a little bit unclear as to how much real danger, because the imagined danger, her hypochondria, that is skyrocketing. Is that supposed to be a metaphor for how she should feel about, like, the state of her actual countrymen and how her people feel about her? And she's projecting that into, you know, breathing her oxygen masks and the spores and whatnot. It's somewhat unclear. That could be it, but I would like to have a more concrete understanding of not only how much danger she is in, but how much danger she thinks she's in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, I mean, like you said, Richard, we hadn't seen her outside of the palace before, and she goes to tour this factory, and obviously everything goes very sideways. But yeah, that again sort of felt like, oh, we're expanding our purview, we're going to a new location, we're going to, like, maybe this union president is going to be, like, a player as the endgame kind of approaches in the last two episodes. And then it's like, oh, no, never mind. Now, actually, we're locking down the palace completely. We're going to stay here. Like, we're not going anywhere. We're, like,
escape the palace.
The three sisters are not going to Moscow. Like,
right.
Time for everyone to accept that. Godot is not going to arrive.
No Moscow.
And it just feels like, I don't know, the contrast. Action just feels like a tease or something, because I just feel like there could be more to do and see and for the show itself to be, and it just doesn't seem interested in doing any of those things. Like, we're just back where we started, and now things are even worse, and I don't
see... And Agnes can't leave now.
Yeah.
Or maybe she'll try. I don't know.
With her son with a terrible breath, which she's doing on purpose.
Yeah. Right. I mean, and yeah, and you people voting against your best interests, I mean, and that's Agnes too, like, and to some degree, you know, Elena's doing the same thing, because she could be maybe trying to make improvements to the nation, and then the people wouldn't be protesting so much.
Yeah, right.
Think about that.
I think what I remain curious about, even though this episode did frustrate me for a couple of reasons, like, I am curious to see, maybe less in terms of the narrative, but, like, what the show, what the writers, what Will Trait decide to do with the character and with, how is this going to end? I mean, because after this episode, I'm like, well, it has to end with her dead.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Like, but maybe I'm not seeing something, or maybe I'm totally wrong. I don't think she gets exonerated, certainly.
Well, or is it so bleak that she remains? Maybe the whole thing is that she actually remains in power, that the regime doesn't end.
I had thought before watching the show, and maybe even the first two episodes, I was like, oh, this is a show about, you know, fascism or something like that. But, you know, as they always said about Mussolini, you know, at least the trains ran on time. Mm-hmm. This is about corruption.
Corruption. Yeah. Into its core.
And it's more about, like, Romania and what happened there under Ceausescu and subsequent leaders than it is about, like, a dictator who is brutal and awful, but, like, would care about sugar beet farmers and would care about the economy beyond their own personal wealth. And so, it's just telling a different story than I thought, I guess. But I do kind of wonder, so does that mean Elena's endgame isn't really the betterment of her nation? She's not a nationalist, actually.
Yeah.
No, her only aim is herself.
It's completely selfless.
Is her plan somehow, is she crazy enough to think that somehow the public tide will turn back toward her and she'll be okay again and it'll just go back to the way it used to be? Or is she, like, planning to flee? Because I'm watching this episode, I'm like, oh, so are you trying to get assassinated? Like, is that the goal? Like, because it's like she's not giving herself any options now, you know?
And I don't know, the fascist take that you described, like, I mean, certainly Zubak feels about her the way that, like, the way that people felt about Hitler or whatever, like, the way... Yeah. That she is this magnetic, like, figure, like, without her, his life is meaningless. Like, she has converted him to, like, the religion of Elena. But, like, he seems to be the only person who feels that way.
We don't know anybody else who feels that way.
And I don't know. Like, if there was a nation full of, like, dear leader, like, lovers, I don't know. I kind of feel like that's a more interesting dynamic.
Well, I think I appreciated about this episode too, especially as you said, Richard, like, tonally, like, every episode feels sort of unto itself, was that we saw how Elena has, like, warped her way into his mind in such a visceral way. He can't sleep. He's listening to her propaganda messages and is hearing, you want to fuck me, you want to fuck me, you want to fuck me. She's got her grips into him to such a degree that, yes, like, I totally believe that he would do absolutely anything and kill anyone for her. But the lack of context of anybody else that we see. We see people being fearful of her in the cabinet, right?
But nobody else seems to love her,
But nobody else seems to love her to that degree. And I'm like, where? And we even went to the sugar beet farms and we had the kids come in and they all seemed sort of like skeptical of me, like, we're just playing along with you because you're a dictator, but we don't love you to that degree, mm-hmm. which is totally fair. But I, again, that is an aspect that is missing, that missing for me, and that I'm sort of confounded.
Yeah, which is like, how has she not been toppled?
And if they stay loyal to her these underlings we see in these conference room meetings and all that, because she's getting them rich, which is all that sort of crony capitalism works, you know, that's, then we need more lines like the one from the guy complaining about the economy and being like talking about his lake house and his son going to Princeton or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's like, I need to more keenly understand why these people don't oust her because she is getting them very rich. Like that money in Belize is
maybe. Yeah, I mean, they tried to once, and then why have they not tried it again, I guess, since the pilot?
Right.
I will say, having gone to Princeton, I knew a lot of kids whose sons were like that. Kids whose parents were definitely involved in some things like this.
I remember sitting at Harvard once. A good friend of mine went there, and it was freshman year, and we were hanging out with some of the kids from her dorm, and I realized that one person to the left of me was a deposed dictator's child, and the person to the right of me had grown up in Anne Boleyn's castle.
Oh, well, you know, and that's a spectrum, and that is like, wow, Harvard diversity.
What a place. Yeah.
America.
Yeah.
And this is why free speech in the Ivy League is so important.
So important. Still watching, we'll be back in just a moment. And when we return, Hugh Grant, who plays former Chancellor Ed Kepplinger, is here.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the Reviews Director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, J. Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as a specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
Well, it's official. The regime is officially not a Love Actually prequel, where he later becomes Prime Minister of the UK.
It could be a prequel for a very British scandal, however.
Yes, true.
We knew from the cast list that Hugh Grant was coming, but we didn't know he'd be here and gone in the span of just one episode.
Yes, which is why it is so exciting that Chris and I got a chance to talk with Hugh Grant, who plays former Chancellor and political prisoner Ed Kepplinger, about his role and the show. So enjoy our conversation. Hello, thank you so much, Chris, for coming to join us and to discuss your time in this unnamed nation, which we on the podcast have been calling Genovia after the Princess Diaries. But I guess we do not know the name of it in real life. If we if we accidentally say Genovia, that's why.
Very good.
So, we were so excited for you to turn up. We did kind of have an inkling about what character you might be playing because there was sort of a lot of buildup to the first appearance of Kepplinger. Yeah.
A lot of references to Kepplinger, you know. And
yeah, so
it had to be somebody of substance.
Yes, exactly. So tell us how you got involved with the show.
Well, it's just Stephen Frears who, you know, drags me to work occasionally. I did Florence Foster Jenkins with him, and then I did, I feel I did something else. Oh, Jeremy Thorpe, the Very English Scandal. And then he, you know, the one thing he's got, well, he's got lots, but the one thing you're almost guaranteed with him is, I think, is interesting material. And he sent me this thing, and I thought it was brilliantly written and funny. And I thought Kepplinger was quite amusingly complicated. And it was rather, the whole thing was rather classy. Kate Winslet, classy, HBO, classy. It was an easy yes.
How much of the show did you read everything up until you appeared, or just your episode?
I only read my lines, obviously. I don't. Of course, I read the whole thing. It was fascinating. And then I had a lot of questions for Will, who wrote it.
What were some of your questions for Will Tracy?
I think I was interested then, and I'm still quite interested to know if Kepplinger is one of those politicians who really believed in his politics, whether he was a genuine lefty who cared about the people, or whether perhaps he had been once, but it had morphed into some kind of vainglorious attention-seeking, and possibly also mixed up with a kind of rabid narcissistic hatred of her, of Elena, and of the fact that she humiliated him. Because I've been around politics in Britain now for 10, 12 years, doing all this campaigning about English press standards. And I've met a lot of politicians, and it's interesting how many of them I would put in that category, where you could say they probably did start at a young age with some ideals. And a few decades later, it's become something less attractive.
So what was the answer? I'm curious. Did he give you one?
I can't remember what he said, but I think the way I finally went into it was that Keplinger himself is not quite sure anymore. Mm. I think although he's outwardly smooth, charming, very sort of eloquent, and he's a clever manipulator. He manipulates Zubak very well. I think deep down he's quite an insecure man.
Hmm.
I always had as a backstory that he'd probably had an affair with Elena years ago, university or something. I can't remember if that's in the edited version. But that maybe hadn't been a great success in bed. I think that Keplinger might be a bit lapsang Souchong between the sheets. He was a bit jealous of Zubak, who probably isn't.
I mean, Elena does make reference to Keplinger's love of his own reflection and his vanity. So,
and we do know politicians like that. We have come across them.
Are you serious?
You don't say.
What a revelation. Yeah, you mentioned your scene with Elena, your scene with Kate Winslet. The two of you obviously have acted together before. You were, in Sense and Sensibility together several years ago, almost three decades ago. What was it like to reunite?
Well, great. I mean, on Sense and Sensibility, she was, I think it was her first film ever. And
I think she had done Heavenly Creatures, I think.
I beg her parsnips. She had done Heavenly Creatures for won prizes. That's rubbish. But she was new enough for Ang Lee to say things to her. I mean, he's a lovely man, as you may know, but he was, partly because of the language barrier, he came across as quite blunt and tactless sometimes with English needy, sensitive actors. And he came from saying to Kate at the end of her first week, "You will get better." It's quite crushing. He also said to me and Emma Thompson after our first scene, "Very boring." So, he was quite blunt. And anyway, I didn't. She was a young girl and clearly brilliant. And look at her now. She's terrifyingly good.
Your scene with her is so fantastic and sort of plays on the vibe of the show, which is darkly comic and yet actually intensely sort of scary. I was sort of worried about Keplinger and his family. Can you talk a little bit about filming that scene with Kate Winslet in your bunker and how you sort of hit on that tricky...
It's a tricky tone.
Tricky
yeah.
tone.
Well, I think Keplinger knows when she comes in that, oh Christ, here we go. I think he gets these periodic beatings from her when things are going badly for her or when she's in a bad mood. So he knows that's happening. I think he has had to eat shit for a very, very long time since she toppled him and imprisoned him because he has to look after his family. I think, the deal was probably... He mentions it in another scene with Zubak that he has to parade. They take him to a sort of country house and parade him as though he's living in exile and still a kind of threat to the regime. And he goes through with the charade, I think, and in return for that, she says, "Your family will be safe." But I think she likes to dick with him sadistically on that issue, which she does at the end of this scene. It's an absolute trump card. And I think he's... at the beginning of the scene, thinks, "Well, I must keep this smooth and calm. I must, for the sake of my family." But something snaps in the middle, and he just can't fucking stand her. And then they go for each other,
kind of like a scorned lover.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think he is. I think also I was very big on his vanity and his narcissism, and I think he just couldn't forgive what she did. Because I don't think it was just that she may have used American influence, American money to slightly fiddle the election that elected her and ousted me. But I think deep down in Keplinger, there may be the nagging fear that actually without any gerrymandering at all, she might have won because she's got the popular touch and he hasn't. I think that sends him into a rage. He's just not the man of the people, wishes he was.
Yeah, I guess you can't really trust a man who keeps trying to get other people to read the book he wrote.
But even there, he's full of double bluff. I hope you haven't read my book.
Yeah, there's a false modesty aspect of it that does
all that, yeah.
Yeah, so were you disappointed to see that Keplinger would be kind of taken off the chessboard now rather than like sticking around until the end of the series? Yeah, I kind of thought
we were disappointed. Yeah. We wanted more Keplinger.
We thought he would be involved in the endgame.
Oh, well, I love you for wanting that. Yeah, maybe that would have been fun. Maybe. And also, I dreaded all that beaten up makeup. I'm too old for any makeup now, let alone prosthetics.
So you didn't mind the ending that he got besides, you know, the makeup?
I didn't mind. Well, I suppose actors always want bigger roles. Maybe. I don't remember feeling particularly chippy about it. I just thought it was a classy thing to come in and do. And I will tell you this. I suddenly realized as he was killing me that I'd never died on camera in 40 years.
Wow.
And I had no idea how to do it. And I said, Stephen, I think I'm going to be shit. I have no idea how to do this. And he said, no, it's wonderful. It's wonderful. But I think it was shit because I've noticed they put in a sort of extra shot of me dying, which is just someone's hand. And it's not even mine. I think it was a reshoot with some double.
Oh, well, it was your first time, you know, just like Ang Lee said to Kate Winslet.
Exactly. Well, maybe it was all too graphic, but I have a nasty feeling I made faces and bulgy eyes and things.
Well, you'll get better. Yeah.
I'll get better.
Yeah.
Do you think that if Keplinger had gotten Zubek on his side, he could have pulled it off? He could have gotten out of that cell?
A coup? And...
No.
Why not?
I think he was stale buns. I think he'd had his go at Chancellor. And there was probably about 5 minutes when the people thought he was the bee's knees. And then I think they thought, he's a bit of a wanker, really. He's not really one of us. He's university educated and sort of part of the liberal elite. And I think they were deep in their populist phase and unlikely to come out of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting that you say part of the liberal elite, because for most of the episode, we are sort of led to believe that Keplinger is a man of the people and he's trying to get Zubek on his side and he's a leftist. And then
he wants to support the farmers.
He wants to support the farmers, the sugar beet farmers. And then he really turns on Zubek right before he gets murdered.
Exactly. That's when his mask slips a little. And actually, he's a bit snobby and he kind of despises the uneducated, especially when they go populist and you know, vote for an Elena or some bullshitter like that. He just can't bear it. And I think there is a bit of elitist in him.
Do you think that quality kind of rings true with real liberal politicians?
Yeah. I believe there are some on the left who really are of the people, come from the people, care about the people. There are no other possibilities for them than that. It's family for them. It's the tribe. But I think that the middle class leftist has to be extremely careful not to fall into the trap of being in it for kind of vainglory and pose. Especially in the age of culture wars, I think you got to be damn careful.
This is not related to the regime, since we have you, I'm so curious. I was looking at your IMDb page and I see that one of your upcoming credits is in Jerry Seinfeld's Pop-Tart movie where you play Tony the Tiger. Is that correct?
Well, I play a rather grand theater actor who really lived and was part of the history of Kellogg's and Pop-Tarts, and they used him in their commercials. And he always felt he was much too grand to be things like Tony the Tiger. So that's the kind of joke. Yes, I am Tony the Tiger, but I'm more the actor who played Tony the Tiger.
Okay. That makes a little bit more sense than if you were just doing the voice for the animated character.
Well, I'd love to see that, too.
Yeah.
I don't know. After an Oompa Loompa, maybe it would not be such a wild swing.
I'm told I'm making strange choices. They don't seem strange to me at all. I just do things that make me laugh, and which I think are, you know, well-written. And Jerry's script certainly made me laugh.
Is there anything that you hope audiences are going to take away from this show, from The Regime?
I consider myself to be in the entertainment business, so it's just entertainment, really. I'm not into messages. I mean, it's clearly saying things about, it's clearly political satire, but I just hope it's entertaining and interesting.
I'm curious, is there a character that you are rooting for now that, you know, you're out of the picture?
No, I don't think that. I can only really root for myself.
That's a great note to end on. Yeah. Thank you so much, Hugh.
Yeah, thanks so much for chatting with us. Still watching, we'll be back in just a moment. And when we return, we make our predictions of who will lead the regime in the end.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
Okay, so we have arrived at the point in the show where we're going to make our predictions about how we think everything is going to end, who is going to be Middle Europe's next chop chancellor. Before we get into that, though, I think, Chris, you have something to share with the class.
Yes, we have an honest-to-God email from a big fan of Still Watching, thank you, Pam, and someone who is loving the regime. Okay, so Pam said, just finished listening to your first episode, and my observation of the first episode, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the intruder that she wakes up and finds in her bedroom is the same guy that they found on two other occasions in parts of the palace where he shouldn't have been. He was always running around with plastic sheeting, and they tell him to get out of there. If he got in, I suspect there are others with nefarious intent. That is from Pam.
That is a good observation. Yeah. I had not realized we had seen the assassin previously.
I have to say, I thought that was the first and only time that we saw the assassin was at the foot.
So good eye.
That is a good eye.
And also, I think that, you know, now that we're a few episodes past that, I think that still we should be keeping an eye out for other nefarious intent within the palace, now that everyone's going to be contained within the palace.
It's got to come from inside.
Now we're in an Agatha Christie, like, closed door situation.
Like, exactly. One of us is a murderer so I'm curious about that. But we also are here, of course, to predict who is on top of Genovia at the end. Winner, of course, gets a one-way ticket to the great nation of Turkmenistan. Let's just recap what we picked last week. Hillary is...
I don't remember what I was talking about.
Hillary, who runs the Club Chalamet Twitter account, picked Timothy Chalamet.
You're profiling me as a 36-year-old white woman.
The shoe fits.
The woman who runs the Club Chalamet account is much older than that.
that is true.
Chris said... Hugh Grant's character, Ed.
Well, that's clearly I'm wrong.
And I said Bartos, the billionaire, though we didn't see him this episode.
We heard his name.
We did hear his name. He's not dead. Zubov, Herbert didn't kill him. So I don't know. What do we think this week, Hillary?
So China's definitely a player in Genovia's, geopolitical sandbox now.
Right.
It may be instead of, like, America toppling the regime. Although, it seems like that there's some sort of CIA plot that
could still be afoot.
Also in motion.
They said they're going to get her. They told Agnes.
Told Agnes. I don't know. Without Agnes's help, can they not, like, achieve this goal? Is that, like, Has she dealt the CIA a fatal blow? Who knows? But yeah, I don't know. Maybe I'm going back to then, like an American puppet or like CIA, some sort of, yeah.
Yeah, I think you had predicted that a couple episodes ago. And that, yeah, that, because like, obviously they have not dropped the America of it all. And, you know, now they're, Americans are making overtures to one of her closest allies.
So. Absolutely. Who, maybe she turns, maybe she doesn't.
I mean, she can still, they can still get in touch with her, even if she, maybe not if the only Chinese electronics are allowed.
Yeah, that's true. But they'll find a way. Yeah, I guess I'm of two minds. I have one that's maybe slightly, you could say, more optimistic, that's maybe more akin to what happened in the Philippines or the Marcoses, where like the, you know, the leader of the opposition is murdered and then the family comes and steps in. Nino Aquino's wife becomes, you know, the leads the Philippines. And so maybe it's, you
Stop
know.
Spoiling, here lies love.
Well, it's closed, Hillary. So good luck seeing that show. But maybe it's, you know, Ed's family. This is slightly more optimistic. Ed's family and Elizabeth.
They were mentioned.
Why would you mention them at this juncture for them not to come or, you know, play some sort of faction? He's dead now. How they would ever get that information, I don't know, but maybe his, you know, goons.
The goons who both beat him and are his friends.
And his friends. Yeah. Maybe they let them know. So I, like, that's slightly more optimistic, but I'm also now starting to think that the show is, like, completely, as Richard said, as we've said, is, like, about, like, complete corruption, the absolute decay, complete collapse. And would anything be, like, worse than Elena still being the ruler by the end, with her still being in charge? So I know I said two completely different answers. I'm feeling optimistic today, so I'll go with my first one.
You're going with Lisbon.
I'm going to go with Lisbon.
You could also read that moment when she says Lisbon as like they've been dead for a long time.
Yeah, forever. He's been dead forever.
Yeah, she had
ever.
Them killed pretty instantly.
I bet heaven is not unlike Lisbon.
Well, poor things would say it's supposed to be beautiful.
I am going to predict that no one is the head of the nation because Elena stupidly starts a nuclear war. And the series ends with everything blowing up.
Well, we've got a doctor. I mean, there's definitely a Doctor Strange love associations and references happening. So I guess that would not be unforeseeable. Yeah.
Well, we will see.
Man, but then that just makes me that's like, what are we doing? Then why did I just watch six episodes?
It's the end of Terminator 3.
Yeah. Oh God.
The end of. Oh my God, the Adam McKay movie about climate change.
Oh, don't look up.
Yes. How could you forget that seminal movie?
Melanie Lynskey's dining room blows up. That does it for this episode of Still Watching. Please become like Pam. Email her Pam and send us any questions, thoughts. I like being pointed out that we missed something. Mm-hmm. Always appreciate that. So stillwatchingpod@gmail.com if you want to do that. We'll try to read the best ones on air. You can also find me, as ever, on social media at Rylaws, R-I-L-A-W-S.
And you can find me on social media at Christris.
And you can find me at Hillabuster.
This has been Still Watching from Vanity Fair. Our producer is Emily Elias, and we had production help from Peyton Hayes. Technical assistance and mixing by Jake Loomis. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer, and our theme music is by Alexis Quadrado. We'll be back next Sunday for Episode 5. Looking forward to seeing you then.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.